Good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen. Welcome to the Moot. Welcome to this afternoon's session where we're going to be looking at Burma 1945. My name is Bertie. I'm the managing director and founder of Sampan Travel. We are the sponsors of today's event, and I'm also going to be the one in discussion with Levison Wood and Alex over the next 45 minutes talking about their upcoming film. My company, Sampan, is quite intimately connected to the history we're going to be looking at today, so I thought by way of introduction to today's discussion, I'll just say a few words about what Sampan does. So we do tours in India, Bangladesh, and Burma. We're actually founded in Burma. Burma's where our head office has been for the last 10 years, and Burma's where I have called home for the last 10 years as well. Who here has been to Burma, just out of interest? I hope that, like me, you believe that it is the most remarkable country with a people that I think are the most wonderful, the most warm-spirited and generous that I've ever come across. Sadly, they have been blighted by horrific leadership for almost, well, over 65 years now. Today, we're going to be talking about Burma 1945, and I think it's important at the outset to recognize that for many people in Burma, that war never really ended. The British left in 1948, and quite soon after that, the first military coup took place, and pretty much consistently since then, the country has been under some form of military rule. In 2010, the country seemed to be making a dramatic U-turn and turning a page towards democracy. When I arrived in 2015, Aung San Suu Kyi was not only out of house arrest, but she was a parliamentarian. And I remember a few months after I arrived, watching on a big screen outside her party headquarters as seat after seat was announced, and she won a landslide victory. It was an incredibly optimistic time for the country. For the first time ever for some of these Burmese, they could start to plan, start to dream of a better, brighter future for not just themselves, but more importantly for the next generation, for their children. Sadly, that came to a close in 2020, or 2021, just after her second landslide election. Hours before she was due to take up her position in Parliament, Aung San Suu Kyi was arrested. She remains detained today alongside her cabinet and thousands of other political prisoners. This was a tragedy for the country because it meant that that new chapter, that new what we thought was a new dawn, actually was more like a blip. And the country has reverted to a norm of military rule, which is quite depressing. That being said, today, Sampan, at that point, we realized it was a tragedy for the country, but it was also a bit of a crisis for Sampan. We ended up branching out to operate in Northeast India, part of the world where we've been talking about today. So those of you who are familiar with the Burma campaign will know that the Burma campaign doesn't just refer to the battles that took place within what we call Burma today, but actually to the fighting that took place in what we today call Northeast India. So the battles in the Naga Hills around Kohima, the battles at Imphal in Manipur. These are the parts of India where Alex and Lev have recently returned to. And it's where we today still do battlefield tours alongside Dr. Robert Lyman, who some of you may know was speaking here this week. We still think it's important to do tours in Burma. It might surprise you that we are still doing tours, battlefield tours in Burma, not just for the economic support that it gives our guides and our supply chain, but actually we believe that doing tours, responsible, safe tours in Burma does help keep the spotlight on that country. And I think particularly historical tours help that. You can't really understand the complexity of what's going on in Myanmar today without having a certain understanding of what happened in 1945. I know that Alex also feels this way. So Alex, he arrived in Burma in 2010. He quite quickly fell in love with the country, but also realized the own gaps in his knowledge of that country, which was perhaps particularly worrying because so much of the recent history of Burma is wrapped up with the history of the UK. Alex has gone to great lengths to rectify that by making a series of fantastic historical documentaries about these hidden histories of Burma. So Alex's first film, We Were Kings, came out in 2012 or something, looking at the last royal family of Burma. He then moved on to make Forgotten Allies, a documentary about the thousands of men that fought in Burma alongside the British and were subsequently forgotten when the British left. The film we're going to talk about today is in many ways a sequel to Forgotten Allies. So Alex has now teamed up with Leveson Wood. Leveson is the fifth in his generation who has fought in the British Army, including his grandfather, who fought in the Burma campaign. What this film explores is Leveson following in the footsteps of his grandfather, who fought in the Burma campaign, but it also explores the narratives of the many thousands of men who fought in Burma alongside the Allies, and are still, some of them, living in a war zone today. This film is particularly important. It's particularly important that it's coming out this year, because this year is, of course, the 80th anniversary of VJ Day. Many of us operating in this sphere often feel that VJ Day doesn't get the recognition or the attention it deserves. So I'm very pleased that this film is coming out this year. And I'm very pleased that so many of you have turned up today to hear Leveson and Alex talk about it. So to start the discussion, I think we're going to watch a trailer of the film. This is the first time any of the public have seen the trailer. So I think we're going to quickly watch that, and then we'll welcome Alex and Leveson onto the stage.
I'm Leveson Wood. 80 years on from the end of the Second World War, I'm following in the footsteps of my grandfather on an incredible journey with my old friend and historian Alex Bescovy.
It doesn't look like Preston anymore.
To a place where the war never really ended.
These kids who are refugees, they've lost everything.
Army checkpoint up ahead.
I know we're a bit stuffed.
Almost everything that could go wrong has gone wrong.
Our mission, to deliver long overdue recognition.
I've got a surprise. I've got a letter from King Charles.
To one of the last surviving veterans.
He is 100 now.
Of the Second World War.
Hello!
Well, gents, welcome back.
Thank you.
Look, Lev, today's session is called My Grandfather's War.
Yeah.
Perhaps we can start, you know, there he is.
There he is.
Talking a little bit about who he was, what your memories of your grandfather are.
Yeah, well, I mean, this idea came as a result. We've been talking about this for many years to do something to commemorate VJ 80. My grandfather served in the latter days of the war. He was a young lad from Stoke. He'd never left Stoke other than some basic training in Preston when he volunteered to sign up in 1943. So he'd done some basic training throughout 1944 and then was sent out to Northeast India where he sort of caught the tail end just after Kohima and then was part of that invading force into Burma through the latter phases of the war. And, you know, I grew up with his stories and I'll never forget. I mean, he sadly passed away back in 2001. So, but I remember as a kid growing up listening to his stories from the war. Like many men of his generation, he didn't tell his son, my father, the stories. But I think he kind of had to get it off his chest at some point. And I remember the times that I spent alone with him, he'd tell me these stories and it was really emotional. And it was part of the inspiration for me to want to see more of the world, to want to travel. And he never had a bad thing to say about the Japanese. That was the interesting thing. He, having spent, you know, time in pretty brutal conditions, he was in the Royal Welsh Fusiliers, you know, an infantry on the ground. It was hard, but he always had a positive. He always wanted to return to Japan, and sadly, he never got the opportunity. So this is kind of my way of paying tribute to not just him, but all of his generation who served in what's often referred to as the Forgotten Army. Yeah. And you know, he had quite an interesting career. He ended up serving after his unit, the Royal Welsh, were taken out of the war in the latter stages of 1945. He then was sent to Japan.
Yeah.
So he was stationed in just outside of Hiroshima, just after the bomb was dropped, for 18 months. So he saw the war out there, and a really, really, and then he went back to Stoke, never to leave again. Amazing. You know, so for him, it was
sensible lad.
Yeah, it was a pretty harrowing time, but also his greatest adventure. And you know, he sort of used to reminisce with me. And this is the kind of tribute. And we started off with quite humble aspirations to make a short film for YouTube, and it seems to have grown a few legs. And I'll let Alex talk about that.
Yeah, well, like you say, I mean, we met long time ago. I think the first time we met, I remember turning up with a sack of books about Burma because you'd said you wanted to go, and I turned up with all my best books on the Burma campaign and never got them back.
Got them somewhere.
Yeah, you've got them somewhere. But no, it was a bond, and we ended up going together.
We went
shortly after, yeah, which was incredible. But then, yeah, since then, obviously, as Bertie mentioned in your very kind introduction, it's been a running theme for me of my filmmaking career, trying to spotlight our connection to Burma, to Myanmar, and those kind of seismic moments in history. And I think you did it really, you know, well. I was there on 2015 that night as well, watching the count, and it's so tragic what's happened, but you can really draw a solid line between the wartime experience and what's going on right now. And I think, you know, as well as this personal journey, it's an amazing way, I think, to bring the British audiences in to understand what happened then and sort of what's happening now.
So just put it in perspective quickly. So for those who aren't too familiar with the Burma campaign, so what the Japanese bomb Pearl Harbor, December 1941, and then in quite quick succession,
simultaneously,
they take over, you know, Singapore, Hong Kong, Malaya, fall very quickly. Mm. They come up through Thailand, enter Burma, end of 1941, beginning of 1942.
Yeah, bombing on Christmas Eve. Yeah.
There we go. Pushing the British back in there, what was then their longest military retreat, I think, in their history, up over the border, into Nagaland, into Manipur, into what's now India. And there, pretty much, the two armies stay where they are. And then till 1944, seismic battles of Kohima, Imphal, that's really the turning point of the battle. And your father turns up, your grandfather turns up sort of just after that.
Just after that. And then in the autumn of 1944, they cross back into Burma and saw out the campaign. Yeah,
fantastic. All right, so then you've got a picture of Kohima here. Forgotten Allies, that was your film, your second film you made, wasn't it?
Yeah. So I made that for VJ75.
Indeed.
I said it was this film that, you know, Lev and I were planning is a follow-up because I'd always wanted to take Lev back to meet some veterans.
Yeah.
But by the time we got round to VJ80, we had a perfect sort of cyclone of COVID, civil war, earthquake. We were about to go in, really, weren't we? Yeah. Then the earthquake hit just a few months ago. And you and I are both trustees of a wonderful charity called Help for Forgotten Allies, which I don't know if you've heard of. Please go look them up. They are taking care of the last surviving veterans from the Second World War, from Burma, who volunteered to fight for the British Army. And this is one, actually, a paratrooper. I don't know if you know the story. He'd obviously never been near a plane until he was taught how to jump out of one. And I went around with the wonderful team, Help Forgotten Allies, actually with your help. You did the logistics for this.
Yeah.
Back in 2017, 18, 19, in the glory days of the Open Myanmar, meeting these veterans who, in many ways, had never, ever been recognized for what they did. They'd been demobbed in 1945. And then 70 years later, we turn up on their doorstep going, here's your pension. Sorry, it's late. But that's, yeah. So, you know, and Lev and I, so, well, I want, the idea is to go back to Burma and meet some more veterans. But, you know, the sad story is that by the time we got round to this year, we could only find one, which is where the idea for the last Burma Star came from. But anyway, so yeah,
So you started in Kohima, is that right?
Yeah.
This recent trip began in Kohima. Tell us about that.
Well, Kohima really, as you rightly pointed out, was the turning point of the war in this theatre, because the two armies, the Japanese knew that pushing into what was then British India would be a huge strategic success if they could pull it off. So there was a bit of a stagnation at this point, while the British Army had a bit of time to regroup, but not just the British Army, it was all of these allied troops, Indians, West Africans. In the Burmese context, it was a lot of the hill tribes, because whilst a majority did join the Japanese side in the central part of the Burman majority, a lot of the ethnic minorities, many of whom were Christian, or animist or whatever, they actually joined the side of the British Army along the sort of sectarian grounds. And so people like the Chin, the Karen, all these different groups were kind of on these borderlands. And we wanted to sort of pay tribute to that, and that's exactly what Help for Forgotten Allies does, right?
Yeah, absolutely. And I think it's an amazing story that goes back. I don't know if you ever saw David Osjoga's brilliant film about the First World War. So we were talking about Chin soldiers. We met, you know, a Chin veteran. They were Chin soldiers fighting on the Western Front.
Ooh. Nagas as well.
Nagas, yeah.
Nagas they were, with their spears.
An amazing story. There's a brilliant friend of ours, Van Kung Lian, who's done a bit of history there. And, you know, these guys, it actually changed the cosmology of the Chin because they'd never left the mountains. Yeah. And they had this whole cosmology that beyond the mountains, there was the end of the universe.
Yeah.
And then all of a sudden, they were put on trains and boats and sent to Belgium. And all of a sudden, they had to rewrite their whole cosmology. But it's, I mean, I'm facetious, but it's, you know, it's an incredibly... It's it gets a severe landscape, beautiful. I mean, you're, you know, you're working at that.
It's superb. And actually, just on that point, you had Nagas actually fighting this in the First World War as well. And actually, they were warring tribes, these Nagas. And it wasn't until they all went to the First World War together and they were on the same side. Actually, they came back and actually began talking to each other rather than cutting each other's heads off.
Yeah.
Which they then used for nationalism. But that's another story.
But I think we owe a huge debt of gratitude to these allies. Back in one of the first things I did when I left the army back in 2011 was I wanted to go to Burma. And it wasn't a particularly easy time to get in then. So I ended up going in via Thailand over the border, hidden in a rice sack, you know, up the River Salween, and illegally ended up sort of being embedded for a short time with the Karen National Army. And I met the commanding officer of the unit, who himself was a sort of slightly older chap in his sort of 60s, 70s. But his dad, who was mid-90s at this point, had fought alongside my grandfather in the Second World War, same units. And it was phenomenal to sort of, you know, he could still recite God Save the King, and he knew the words of command. And but what was really sad was to think that these people had been oppressed and persecuted and basically not been able to leave that part of the jungle for, at that point, the best part of 65 years.
Yeah.
And to this day, it's the longest running civil war in the world. And it's very sad. So, you know, this really felt, it's as much about my grandfather as it, but really it's about the allies and those amazing communities of people that still recall those wartime days to this day.
Well, just before we go on from Kohima, sorry, I mean, that one, that photo before, I mean, who here has been to Kohima? Have you been with Bertie? Because I mean, it's an amazing. I mean, full credit to the Commonwealth War Graves Commission. You know, it's beautifully preserved on this hilltop, and I think the picture. Yeah, you can see that. For those that know your wartime history, this is the tennis court over which the Japanese and, you know, the Commonwealth forces were fighting, and it's, you can read about it, but it's not until you stand there on this actual tennis court and realize that they were lobbing grenades at each other from, you know, either sort of baseline. And it brings it home of just the brutality and the closeness of this. Yeah. And I think, you know, the Kohima, very, very encouragingly, was voted in a poll, I think, the greatest military victory of all British history. Yet I'd behave that not that many people know the story.
And what's interesting, that it wasn't that British as well.
No.
I mean, you've got a lot of those soldiers from all over the world. Yeah. West Africans, East Africans, Gurkhas, Burmese.
Yeah. Precisely. No, it was very, very moving to go back there.
Yep. Okay, so you were in Kohima, and then after Kohima, you went to Assam. Is that right?
We went down to Assam, Mizoram, and...
okay, so this is, I think you...
This is near to Shillong, right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Where your grandfather did his training,
He did his basic training, well, the sort of the secondary phase before they went into Burma, they had to get acclimatized. Yeah. And I remember my grandfather, his biggest concern in the jungle, it wasn't the Japanese, it was the leeches. He hated the leeches, and... So this is where they went and did their jungle warfare training. But it was only a matter of weeks before they were then sent over the border to go and fight.
Fantastic. Okay. Yeah. So after Assam, you then travelled south, I think, didn't you?
We did.
On the hunt for a particular person,
yeah. I believe. obviously, this is a Burma Star, if you hadn't heard one of these. But just before then, I mean, it was very... it was actually very moving. We were standing looking over the Brahmaputra, weren't we? And I think it would have been your granddad's 101st... birthday when we were there
on that day.
Yeah. And I think what people, I certainly, before I started researching and working on this period of history, is that I was taught about Dunkirk and D-Day and the, you know, the race for Berlin and all that sort of stuff and the Battle of Britain. I didn't realize that, you know, a few days after D-Day landings, your granddad's been put on a boat and shipped out east, you know, and when VE Day is being celebrated, the lads in the Far East were getting stuck into some of the fiercest fighting, you know, and your granddad was being sent out there, kind of as the tide of war was turning to start a whole new chapter. Mm. And I think when we stood you know, in that previous photo, we sort of, yeah, doesn't look like Preston anymore. But it was, you know, we went through, Lev took us through a yomp, because you've actually done proper jungle training, haven't you? Mm. In, what is it, Belize?
In Belize, but, yeah. You know, same sort of thing, really, just really sweaty, very humid, lots of that things out there that can hurt you or at least make you very ill.
Yeah.
And I think just to be immersed in that environment, and we sort of talked through it, didn't we? All these horrible sort of ways that had you know, things like punji sticks, booby traps, snipers tying themselves to trees, so that even if you shot them, you didn't know if you'd hit them or not. You know, all these horrible ways that you could potentially meet your end. And for, you know, imagine being a young lad, 18, 19, 20 years old, suddenly thrown into a very alien environment. Pretty harrowing. We wanted to go and immerse ourselves in that without getting shot at. although we did have a few mishaps on the journey, didn't we?
I mean, obviously, we had originally wanted to follow the entire breadth of your grandfather's awesome story. Because, you know, you mentioned it about him being deployed to Japan, you know, weeks after the Hiroshima bomb was dropped. So he was sent to Hiroshima, I think.
He was in Hiroshima, Kure, and spent almost 2 years in Japan.
So our original idea had been to go through India, through Myanmar, onto Japan, and then this is a particular bugbear of mine, very difficult to get commissioners to engage with VJ Day. So I'm very delighted that you've come to this, what is a VJ 80 talk, really, because it always gets forgotten. So we pushed on and pushed on to make this story and end up, we were going to go into Myanmar, but then the earthquake happened. So in the middle of all this, we had a challenge. So I said at the beginning, we wanted to try and find this one man that we had on our books who was fit enough mentally and physically to come and meet us and wasn't living in too much of a war zone to be able to cross the border or at least meet at the border in India. And the idea that, you know, this film was supported by the Burma Star Memorial Fund, who provided us both with the, you know, some of the cash to help us make it, but also with a very precious Burma Star, which your granddad obviously got, and anybody who fought in the Burma campaign should have got. But this weird quirk of history that Burma left the Commonwealth it left the empire and didn't join the Commonwealth. So it was excluded from this broader network of welfare and fell into civil war. So all the lads that had fought never got their medal. So we sort of want to do a kind of symbolic search.
So this chap, he comes from the Chin Hills, I believe, right? There's this Colonel Sonhun. Yeah.
So Corporal Sonhun, we knew very little about him apart from that he'd actually joined the British Army twice.
Okay.
I don't know if you can still do that, but he joined before the Japanese invaded in the Chin Hills, the Chin Levies. When that massive disastrous retreat happened, he'd gone home, you know, back to sort of see what happens. And then when post Kohima, when Lev's grandfather comes back and they reinvaded Burma, he joined up for a second time. So we had this kind of description of service that had been provided by Help Forgotten Allies. But all we really knew is that he was about 100 years old and living in a village, which at that point was on the front line. This is in April, just gone.
Yeah, yeah.
On the front line of the new civil war. And I mean, we were working with our friend Van. I mean, do you remember that phone call we had? Because we were obviously trying to meet this guy in the middle of a war zone, basically.
Well, the one of the issues that we had was communicating with him. Obviously, he's 100. His son, David, was very helpful and said, look, I'll bring my dad and we'll try and get as close to the border. You can come and meet us at the border. But then because of the fighting that was going on, bear in mind, this was just in the wake of the big earthquake that recently happened too, the Burmese army had shut down all the Wi-Fi, so they couldn't get any phone signal. So we sort of agreed to meet this chap on the Burma-India border, and we'd already set off at this point, and then we had no communications for several days while we were trying to just hope that he was able to cross this war zone to come and meet us. I mean, the old boy was game. He was like, I'd love to come and get my medal. So we'd agreed a day, but we didn't know if we were going to meet him. So there was lots of unknowns. And then to make matters worse, I don't know if we've got any pictures, but we got stopped by the Indian Army because they said, look, you can't go any further.
Yeah. So we traveled for 8 days, I think, across, and we'd done a flight every single day to get all the way to the end and then done about sort of 14-hour drive.
And we were about 3 kilometers away from the Burmese border, and then there was an Indian Army checkpoint.
No further. So it was just a bit gutting. But,
Well, I mean, so we were then thinking, okay, the whole thing's a total disaster at this point, thinking, okay, well, we're going to have to go back to, what's the name of that town?
Champai.
And then we finally got communications with Son He and his son David.
Yeah.
And they were like, well, we're at the border. And we're like, well, we're not. And then we said, well, is there, because I mean, obviously he's Burmese and I don't think he has a passport. And he was like, look, we'll smuggle ourselves into India. And we're like, are you sure? And anyway, he was up for it. So he then somehow gets through the army checkpoints, I suppose, because he's 100 and get away with it.
It's all like jungle training.
And then came to meet us in Champai, in this refugee camp. So the 100-year-old guy managed to smuggle himself through the borders, and we didn't.
Here he is.
And there he is. And we gave him not only his medal, but I'd become friends with the King's equerry, a guy called Johnny Thompson. And
thank you, Johnny.
He managed to get a letter from King Charles to give to Son He, which was just a phenomenal, icing on the cake, wasn't it?
Well, it was, I mean, behind the scenes. So this is something that Levitt had secretly been trying to work out. And then it looked like he was sort of all talk, no trousers, because we were day before meeting Son He, after all this, there's still no letter from the King. Anyway, it turned up by WhatsApp.
Yeah, I got a WhatsApp from the palace.
And then I queue myself and Luke, our director. I think it's in... Where are you, Luke?
He's hiding out.
He's just turned up. He'll be absolutely gutted. He hasn't slept for about 3 weeks making that trailer that you couldn't see. So I'd be absolutely gutted. Luke and I were running around Champai trying to find a framers. And so this guy opened his printing shop at about 10 p.m. at night.
Well, it was Easter Day, wasn't it? Was it Easter Day that you met?
This was Sunday. This was the eve of Easter Sunday. Oh. I'm running around, trying to get a guy to open up a print shop in the night. So there's a story behind that too. But if we just go back one.
Yeah.
Obviously, you mentioned refugee camp. And obviously, we're doing this lovely World War II history story. We'll come back to Son He in a minute because we'll talk about that meeting. It is, as you said, an active civil war.
Mm.
And for any of you who sort of know that geography, in the state of Mizoram and Chin State on the other side of the border, I mean, the border is a kind of British fiction, basically.
I mean,
either side of the border, they are Chin, Mizo, they speak similar-ish languages, and that's why they can kind of just fluidly move across the border. But tens of thousands of Myanmar Chin have just come over the border into Mizoram and are now living in camps.
You've got about 30,000 in Mizoram,
yeah,
I think. And actually, it's quite interesting. So Delhi, since the civil war in Myanmar began, Delhi have pretty much said, don't let the refugees in.
Yeah.
Because Mizoram has such close, ethnic ties to the Chin across the border, they've actually welcomed all these refugees. And I think about between 30 and 40,000 Chin refugees are currently in Mizoram. A lot of their children are going to their schools, and they've been allowed to stay, which I think is very commendable to the Mizo government to be welcoming them in.
Well, also, I'd say another plug for Help Forgotten Allies. Sorry, we're both trustees, so we'll do it. They're also using some of their money, as well as caring for veterans, to run a night school, which we visited, didn't we? I mean,
well, this is a girl this from is the it. Night school, this I believe. Yeah.
I mean, yeah, it was the longest day of the trip, I think. We'd been turned over the board. We thought it was all over. And then we were welcomed into this school where these kids who were falling out of the school system and their parents turned up to see us. I mean,
it was Easter, so they were on holiday. So they came in just to welcome us. And the welcome was phenomenal. They did some of their indigenous songs and talked about their heritage. And I think just that sense of remembrance is very powerful to them because they trace a lot of their semi-autonomous state to the fact that they did support the British. I've never received much of a thank you since then, and so I think for us to go there, they felt that there was some recognition at least, and I think that's why it's important to keep doing these things.
Well, I was there about 3 years ago, and very sweet children, very, very charming, and very sort of smiley and jolly considering what they've been through. I mean, one girl I spoke to sort of pointed up at the hilltop where her village had been, 3 months previously and had been burnt down. But I think what's important about schools like this is that although Mizoram have welcomed the children into their schools, they're not learning Burmese, which of course is the national language of Myanmar. So if these children want to go back to Myanmar one day, schools like the Phoenix School are making sure they are learning Burmese. So one day, hopefully, they can return to Chin State in Myanmar and continue their studies there.
Well, it's an interesting thing because, you know, I've spent a lot of time meeting the veterans in Myanmar. And we do sort of talk about end of, you know, what happens when you're all gone.
Yeah.
And they said, well, if you've got any money left over, please, please do spend it on education of our descendants. So we didn't expect to be doing that, you know, in a war zone again. But it was sort of a pledge that they asked for and, and we fulfilled. And and just one story, because these, you know, these are the descendants of, you know, men who fought alongside your grandfather. And I don't say that kind of like, that's vaguely connected. There was one guy in the school who was called Japan Hrang, which he was named after his grandfather, who essentially meant hero of the Japan War. And, you know, he's literally named after the fact that his grandfather had fought, and he was very, very famous for having fought with the British against Japan. And now he's sat in a refugee camp. So the very, very real link.
Well, let's crack on with your story. So the colonel, so you met him. How was that, Lev?
Corporal. Sorry. Yeah, I mean, he was...
Britain.
I mean, just going back to that, you know, we had to sort of double translate because he was speaking Chin that then got...
A dialect of Chin.
Yeah. So it was an amazing opportunity, I think, just to look somebody in the eyes who was there in this final phase of the war. And he was describing not only his sort of time then, but also the fact that he sort of just shrugged off, very resilient Stoic people, that he shrugged off the fact that his village had just been bombed last week.
By a modern fighter jet.
A fighter jet. And it was just very poignant, I think. But his main priority, and then one of the main reasons that he wanted to come, not only to get his medal, was that he was just desperate because he'd never actually been to the Indian towns around there. He'd never crossed the border in his 100 years, and he wanted to go to the dentist.
Yeah,
so fantastic.
We sorted that out and he had a great time.
Yeah. No, he was an amazing character. I mean, here we are.
Well, there you are. Shall we do this? So this is the team. I mean, the team is a very small team.
That's it.
You know, sort of done on a shoestring. Am I right? I mean,
absolutely.
Yeah.
As I said, it's a bit of a
passion project for you.
It was a passion project and it gets me because I had the same issue 5 years ago at VJ75 where the government's wrapped up in doing VE and, you know, the whole narrative. And then they finish VE and go, oh crap, we need to do something on VJ. We don't really understand it. Yeah. So I think we wanted to contribute to that conversation. And, you know, the importance is, and you touched on it at the beginning when you were talking about Gehima, it's that, you know, people say, well, why do we remember the VJ? Because if these guys hadn't stood up, you know, and stopped the Imperial Japanese at the gates to India, and if they had invaded India and knocked India out of the war, or, you know, India had joined the other side, or whatever, you know, it could have undermined the entire, certainly the British and Imperial war effort. It might not have changed the final outcome of the war. It certainly would have elongated it. And I think it's really important to remember, you know, like your grandfather, just as everyone else is starting to wind down and celebrate, he's going out to some of the most brutal fighting, of all. So we did have a tiny team. You know, Luke is right there, who's the director of the film. Evie, who produced it with us, and we legged it round for 9 days, barely stopped, almost all fell apart. But we're delighted to say, we can reveal to you first, it's coming out on Remembrance Sunday on Sky History, The Last Burma Star. So I hope that you'll tune in and watch it. We'll be at VJ Day on the 15th of the Arboretum, saying thank you to Johnny Thompson for getting that letter. And yeah, it's I think it's really important. I guess all of you are here because you agree. maybe you've got family who fought, you know, maybe you've been, but it always is, it's the poorer cousin. But I still think it's incredibly important, particularly while the veterans are still alive, I think.
Yeah.
And is there a way, I mean, how can people sort of follow the progress of the film, or is it just sort of waiting until the November? Are there...
Well, I think we're going to do a premiere. I think we're going to do a ticketed event probably at the Imperial War Museum at some point.
Okay. Before it goes out.
Before it goes out on TV.
There'll be a trailer then, maybe.
Is the trailer working yet, do we think? We can do it.
Oh, great. Let's do that.
Okay.
Oh, my God. Yes, watch it.
One more go.
Then Luke can die happy.
Let's hopefully this works this time.
I'm Levison Wood. 80 years on from the end of the Second World War, I'm following in the footsteps of my grandfather on an incredible journey with my old friend and historian, Alex Bescovy.
It doesn't look like Preston anymore.
To a place where the war never really ended.
These kids who are refugees, they've lost everything.
Army checkpoint up ahead.
and I'm a bit stuffed.
Almost everything that could go wrong has gone wrong.
Our mission, to deliver long overdue recognition.
I've got a surprise. I've got a letter from King Charles.
Wow, that's absolutely amazing.
To one of the last surviving veterans.
He is 100 now.
Of the Second World War.
Hello.
I mean, should we just, let's talk about that Easter Sunday, because it was mad. I mean, everything was going on. So we were originally supposed to meet him on the border, and then we end up in a three-hour church service in three different languages. None of them English, obviously, because we're in Northeast India. But do you remember, you obviously remember that morning?
Yeah, I mean, it was a really powerful moment for me to just go and sort of do this closure for this journey that for me has been, you know, of huge interest for my entire life. And I think it's so powerful, so important that we recognize those enormous sacrifices made by those young lads of any nationality and any race and religion that served in this campaign. I'd just like to make it not the forgotten army and not the forgotten war. And that's why we thought this was important. And I'm just blown away, actually, because we thought we were going to go and do this for a 15-minute clip on YouTube and we paid for ourselves. And then suddenly, you know, we've had this huge interest from all sorts of different people. Joanna Lumley.
Yeah, we should name check a few,
you know,
people.
Well, please, yeah.
Well, Dame Joanna Lumley.
Yeah.
Personally supported this project, bless her. Yeah. Not supposed to say that out loud, but I've just done it.
We are still trying to raise funds. So if there's anyone here,
thank you.
I'll throw that in.
no, really. We have been supported by, you know, the Burma Star Memorial Fund, who've been amazing. Help Forgotten Allies themselves.
Yeah.
Put, you know, a tiny bit of their, you know, very important cash into this, because I think it helps spread the message of what they're doing. I hope you go and look at them up. The Royal British Legion Industries, amazing, amazing. Nothing to do with the Royal British Legion. Go and look them up. They're absolutely fascinating. Look after veterans, you know, to rebuilding their lives after the army. And the Gurkha Welfare Trust, amazing team. Thank you for always being supportive. The Gurkhas, obviously, you know, that memorial at Kohima, you know, I think the thing that strikes you, like you say, I mean, 85% roughly of the 14th Army were not British.
Mm.
And you go up to that wall and it's the Punjab Regiment, the Sindh Regiment, you know, the Gurkha Regiments, the West African Regiments. But then as well, you see the Yorkshire, the Manchesters, the Derbyshires. It's just, I'm going to plug your tour.
You can plug my tour.
If you do one thing, if you've got any connection to this campaign, before you leave God's green earth, book a tour with Bertie and go to Kohima. You will not forget it.
It's a wonderful tour. Thank you, Alex. Well, look, I think we've got time for some questions.
Yeah.
So, ladies and gents, any questions? Before I forget, again, after the questions, Alex and Lev are going to be signing books.
Ooh. Are we?
Yeah.
Right, cool. But you are now.
Have you written a new one?
I've written a book about trees. Absolutely nothing to do with this. But it's really interesting.
But it's a very good book.
Do you and mention, history.
Do you mention Burma history at all in there?
Yes.
Oh, you do?
There we
pretty
go.
Much every country Burmese in the world trees gets mentioned.
So I think in Waterstones, just at the entrance, okay, Alex and Lev will be signing books.
Fantastic.
So if you have any questions, I think raise your hand and someone will come and find you. Yes, this gentleman here in the glasses.
Regret putting this on.
Thank you. Thank you very much indeed. Going to the Forgotten War bit, just curious, because obviously your connections into the film industry, why none of the big names or the big producers, to my knowledge anyway, have never actually done an equivalent to, you know, the sort of Germany-France campaigns? Why have they not done that? And are there any plans to do one?
That's a really good question. Mm. We've been pushing that for a while. Mm. It's a tough one. It seems like, you know, D-Day gets all the love, doesn't it? And we've been trying to get you know, as much exposure for this through the work with charities, and you know, we're trying to push hard. So hopefully that will change at some point, because I think it's such an important story to tell. And there's an America, you know, if the Americans want a bit of, you know, they were there, you know.
Oh, yeah.
And
Merrill's Marauders.
And so I think we just need to, it's more of an education piece, and just make sure we get it in front of the right people. Steven Spielberg's father actually served in that campaign too. So
Steven Spielberg is here,
come and speak to us afterwards.
You've got a few quid. No, I think my answer to that question is, it's just a more complicated story.
Yeah.
I think it's harder to tell. And like, you do have to deal with it with quite a lot of nuance because, you know, Burma was essentially the front line of a battle between two empires. You know, it's called the Burma campaign, but it's sort of, it's a war that happens to Burma. And, you know, like Lev touched on at the beginning there, you know, young men from either side had to choose, you know, do you join the Japanese who've just invaded or do you just stand and fight with the Brits? And you know, neither of them are great choices, to be honest, because what a lot of them wanted was their own independence from this, you know, this federal structure of Burma. And, you know, you mentioned the Karen and the Kachin and the Chin. You know, we made all sorts of promises to these sort of indigenous hill tribe communities saying, well, you fight for us, you can have a state afterwards. And then we bug it off. So it's not a clear cut goodies, baddies, you know, stand and defend the homeland. It's a bit more complicated, but it doesn't.
We met another guy on the way to meet Corporal Songha.
Great story, yeah.
He'd jumped both sides. He was like, we can't quite like the Japanese, actually. They were good to us. They brought us food and then he joined the Brits. And
yeah.
But, you know, some of these communities were split. So, yeah, you're right. Not black and white.
And I think the legacy point is also just, I'll keep banging on about it, but like it weaponized already present sort of ethnic, religious divisions inside what's an incredibly complicated country, ethnically, linguistically, religiously. And, you know, essentially it armed both sides. And then those empires withdrew and then, you know, quickly granted independence as kind of afterthought. And like you said, the First Civil War begins in 1949 when the Karen, who had been fighting very bravely for the British Army in Operation Character with the SOE, they said, no, we're going to go for it now. We're going to push.
And they almost did. They almost took Yangon.
Yeah.
They had taken Yangon Airport in August 1949. You know,
you could have been talking about
would be a very different country, or possibly two countries.
Yeah,
and they didn't. They just managed to get men across from the Arakan, I think, into Rangoon.
It's amazing, and I think you know you can. Oh, sorry, I can go on and on.
Yeah, but take another question.
Sorry.
Yeah, at the back here, please.
We've got 15 minutes, right?
No, we've got more. I think
no.
Is it? We've got 4 hours.
Yeah.
Sure.
What nobody has said yet is what is happening on the ground. Are the Tatnodor in charge? Are they beginning to lose against all the many tribes against them? I'd be fascinated to know.
Yeah, there's not as much coverage from the ground in Myanmar as there should be. We've sort of reached a stalemate slightly. The Tatmadaw, which is the Burmese military, actually came out of the ashes of the Second World War. Trained by the Japanese. You know, they are the weakest they've ever been, but they're not quite weak enough to be knocked out by the liberation forces. And the problem is the liberation forces are a real disparate, fragmented bunch. So you've got ethnic armed groups like the Karen that Alex was speaking about, who've been fighting since the Second World War. You've got, you know, young men and women who, you know, 5 years ago were maybe, you know, working in IT in Yangon, who've been trained in the jungle since the coup, who are fighting them. And you've got various other forces as well. So you've got a very fragmented picture. Essentially, where we go, of course, it is safe and it's under military control, Yangon, Mandalay area. But pretty much all around the frontier areas, it's either under liberated control, so it's called a free zone, or they're fighting. And unfortunately, I don't really see, you know, where this goes next, because like I say, neither side is quite strong enough to have a clean victory. So whatever happens, I fear it's going to be a long and protracted struggle for Myanmar. Yes, just here, please.
Yeah, thanks very much. I'm quite interested to know your views on the contribution of the Africans in the Burma campaign. Obviously, the West Africans you've mentioned already, and the environment was very similar. The East Africans, however, there's not much jungle in East Africa. And I just wondered whether Lev, in particular, your grandfather, ever mentioned the contribution of the Africans. And I think it was quite considerable, in fact.
No, it was a huge contribution to the war. My grandfather spoke highly of all of the troops that he served with, particularly the Gurkhas. He loved the Gurkhas. He mentioned the Africans. He mentioned, you know, they were fighting alongside the Chinese at this point, remember, in parts. And so, you're right. It's really important to recognize that this was such a multi-ethnic, multi-faith fighting force that was sort of cobbled together out of all these different units, different parts of the world. And forced into this campaign in a very hostile environment in the jungle. And you're right, you know, for a lot of these people, that was the first time they'd seen jungle. It certainly was for my grandfather. And so you can imagine it was a pretty harrowing, tough environment to get used to.
Well, it's a beautiful film by Griff Rhys-Jones, which really inspired my first film on this. And he takes a Ghanaian veteran back, and I think his name's Joseph. And he makes that point. It's like, they recruited us because they thought we lived in the jungle. So I live in arable Ghana. We are literally no more, than boys from Wiltshire, to be honest. And it is amazing. It is amazing to see, you know, the 14th Army particularly. We haven't even mentioned Bill Slim, obviously, but this incredible achievement of cobbling together this million-man fighting force of all these different ethnicities and religions and dietary rations and stuff like that to turn them around and defeat what up to that point had been this terrifying, undefeatable force. It's an amazing story.
Yeah, in the middle, please.
Thank you very much. Very interesting talk. I think my father, John Shipster, was an exact contemporary of your grandfather. He was born in 22. He was commissioned into the Indian Army, Punjab Regiment, 1941, fought at Kohima, Arakan, and so on.
Wow.
There are a couple of elements of complexity in the story which you haven't mentioned, which I think might be of interest. So I don't have a question, but maybe a contribution. First is the Indian National Army, which fought with the Japanese. And in India today, across almost every town of any size, you'll see a statue to Subhas Chandra Bose, the leader of the Indian National Army. He went to Berlin, he met Hitler, he went to Japan by submarine, he led this army, which the Indian Army of the time didn't take much account of, but which is a very important part of the sort of, if you like, I was going to say mythology, but maybe I say legacy of India and present day India, which Modi himself is very much a part of. The second thing is the contributions of the Americans, which should not be neglected. If it wasn't for the American Air Force supplying Imphal, Kohima, and the units that fought along the sort of Chindit front, the campaign would have gone very, very differently. And of course, the third dimension is that my father's company, which was Muslim, went to Pakistan after partition, and it's a terrible irony that great army, that was such a unifying factor in India, 1.5 million volunteers, largest volunteer army ever assembled, should now be teetering on the edge of war, and with little prospect of permanent reconciliation. So I'm sorry there's not a question there, but I hope you don't mind.
Thank you very much.
I'll pick up on one of those things. I mean, I don't know if you were in Sam Dalrymple's talk on the five partitions yesterday, or Sam's in here, but it's definitely a book that we should look more into about the effects of those partitions, particularly the Burma partition. But a couple of books that really inspired me, Yasmin Khan's The Raj at War, tells about this, how India at the time, Indians at the time, were thinking about their role in World War II. And on the fiction side, Amitav Ghosh's Glass Palace, if you haven't read that, it tells one of the most heartbreaking personal stories of a young Indian soldier who is like the fifth generation of his family to join the second Rajputs. Really, really proud. He's fighting for the empire. And then watching that fall apart during his fight with the Japanese. It's really affecting story of how that, like you say, it starts to crumble and become very complicated.
Yeah, I'd also add to that Srinath Raghavan's India at War. It's a superb account of India's experience during the Second World War. It's a wonderful book. Yes, next question, please, just down here.
Thank you very much. That was a really evocative discussion. I suspect like many in here, we have uncles who fought in that war, and it's something I'm trying to research myself. But the question is actually about pensions. You made passing reference to pensions, and we have not got a very good history in terms of paying pensions to people like the Gurkha. What's the situation in Myanmar?
I should clarify my use of the word pension. I was being a bit throwaway. So my understanding is that if you are a Commonwealth soldier, you're not entitled to a pension in the sense of a serving British veteran, and this is where the complexity of the Gurkha story comes in, but you are entitled to welfare payments and essentially stopping any veteran falling into kind of irreversible poverty. And also, so in Myanmar, Help Forgotten Allies, we extend a network which we look after the veterans till the end of life. We look after medical bills, funeral costs. We support their widows. And it's, you know, it's the Royal Commonwealth Services League, which you've probably never heard of. It was founded at the same time as the Royal British Legion to precisely to look after those, you know, millions of veterans from across the Commonwealth. And they're still going, you know, they're still going today. They don't trumpet themselves very much, but they've always supported our work. They support Help Forgotten Allies. And it's very much about these, you know, what for us are tiny amounts of money, my Uncle Andy right there is the treasurer. So he'll be able to tell you exactly, two down from you, what they get. But it's not a lot of money for us. You probably spent more at the bar this week, but it's life-changing for these guys. In fact, Son Hur said the reason he'd made it to 100 is because Help Forgotten Allies have been looking after him, which is very lovely. Yeah, please.
Thank you for your talk. I just wondered if in this research you'd heard more stories about from the retreating forces as the Japanese invaded. My grandfather, having survived the First World War, then extending his commission into the Indian Army, came out into Civvy Street in the early 30s, but joined the garrison in Burma to try and hold off the Japanese and was part of the retreat. They, having been beaten at Mandalay, apparently then they disappeared into the jungle and were missing, presumed dead, missing in action. And eventually, some months later, appeared over the border in India and apparently covered in tropical sores and malnourished. But surprisingly, he wouldn't talk about that at all. He would be quite open about talking about the trials and tribulations of the First World War. And I took that to be a reflection of just how much more awful it was. And I just wondered if you'd come across stories or you know, writings about that aspect of it.
Yes, there's a lot on it. I think they referred to it as the Great Trek, and I think it was utterly horrendous, and many, many people died. So you had obviously the military, the British Army retreating, but you also had thousands and thousands of civilians, those who hadn't got out from Mandalay or from Rangoon in time. And you had sort of corpses rotting, you know, on the side of the road. It would have been what, start of the monsoon.
Yeah.
Okay, so you'd be going through, you know, horrendous rain. And yes, I mean, it was a really horrific experience for all those who did it and those who survived. And horrible stories of, you know, mothers dying on the track and their children sort of, you know, alive, sort of, you know, still with them, trying to wake them up. In fact, I think Slim actually found a boy, General Slim, found a young boy who was sort of, you know, tugging at his dead mother on the side of the street, an Indian boy, I think. And anyway, sort of popped, you know, picked him up and gave him to a soldier, and he was brought back to India. But yes, it was horrific. And I think no wonder, was it your grandfather, you said, no wonder he wouldn't want to speak about it. It was awful. I would just say quickly as well, I think a slight stain on the record of the British at that moment of our history, there were two routes out of Burma, one much easier than the other. The one that was easier was reserved for the military, and all civilians were told to go on the harder route. But in reality, plenty of European civilians were allowed on this much easier route. And, you know, taking all sorts with them. And a lot of Indians were relegated to this much harder trek out of India. And certainly in India today, when I speak to Bengalis who had family who did that trek, they feel it very keenly that there was that discrimination at that time.
Well, I don't know if you've ever eaten in the restaurant Mandalay. It was for very many, many years the only Burmese restaurant in England. It was in on the Edgware Road.
Mm. Isn't it still there?
They've moved a little bit further out. But the guy that founded that walked out. He was actually an Indian, but he was born in Rangoon, and he walked out and eventually ended up, after a long, convoluted story, opening a Burmese restaurant in London. So I keep stumbling on this. It's a really, really, really complex one.
Yes. In the corner.
Perhaps you could, if you bring into context, as Bertie knows, and Robert Lyman know, the massive numbers of support operations before Kohima took place, to just bring into context that huge numbers of different Commonwealth supporters coming up to Manipur, and then thereafter, and also losses on the Japanese side. The huge logistics are as important as the bravery at the front line.
Yes, I mean, so Calcutta was essentially the HQ of the 14th Army. And if you were operating in Kohima, as they were, I mean, that is an incredibly long supply chain you're having to operate over. I don't know what, I mean, Rob Lyman has a great sort of analogy. Is it sort of London to Moscow, from Yangon to Calcutta? But it's a huge, huge amount of distance. Mm. And I think one of Slim's greatest achievements as the commander of the 14th Army wasn't just fighting on the battlefield. It was actually organizing that army. And the men who were in charge of the logistics actually were as important as anyone who was commanding the forces on the fighting ground. Mm. So, yeah, 100%.
A distant cousin of mine, who we used to, as small children, call the King of Burma, was a mining engineer in Burma prior to the war. And of course, he joined up as he had to, but he was leading one of the two marches out of Burma because he knew the geography of the country, having been there for a few years. He started this, now this isn't probably accurate, but we always heard he started with 800 in his march and ended with 40, all the rest dying en route in the most tragic circumstances.
There is a book called Goodbye Burma. It's not fiction. It's a family history. I forget the name of the author, but it traces that route back of one family from Burma to Calcutta. Goodbye Burma.
Well, I think book. If we do anything with this film, it's being able to bring these stories back, because it's not a finished story. As I said, Son Heung right now has gone back into Chin State, where the political military future of Chin State is still in question, whether the army will reinvade or whether his house is getting bombed. So I hope that, you know, as well as bringing up these wonderful family stories, you'll pay a thought to the veterans still living in Myanmar right now. And I hope you enjoy the film.
Yeah.
Still looking for funding. Do come and talk to us.
Anyway, thanks so much.